Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and once again, welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And we've got a real treat today. We're going to be speaking with Guy Walters, author of numerous books about Nazi Germany, with forthcoming title about Joseph Mengele coming out in the foreseeable future. And today we're looking at an aspect of history which is at once highly mythologized and yet with a kind of a fascinating core of truth to it. And that is the escape of Nazi war criminals to South America, a topic where kind of fact and fiction have become so blurred over the years. We really do need an expert to help navigate these kind of complexities. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Guy Walters to the Explaining History podcast. So I'd like to welcome to the podcast now Guy Walters. Welcome, Guy. We are going to talk today about the legacy, really, of the Second World War and the fate, for want of a better word, of those Nazi war criminals who evaded justice and escaped to South America. So, I think the first question, Guy, is how was it that so many figures in the Third Reich had this connection with South America? How can we explain that?
It's a very good question, and before I begin, I just want to apologise for the fact that I have a nest of sparrows living in my office above my head, and so if you hear some cheeping and tweeting going on, that's what that's all about. But so it's a little sort of charming rural backdrop to my words, yes. I hope, while we're talking about the grimness of Nazis. To go back to your question, though, South America wasn't the only place that Nazis liked running away to. I mean, there were other favoured retirement destinations for your Nazis, such as the Middle East, which was quite popular. Spain was quite popular for a while. But yes, I think in the public imagination, or the popular imagination, then certainly it's South America, it's Argentina, it's Brazil, are the two big countries.
Yeah.
Now, the reason for why they went to South America is that there were well-established German communities in those countries. For about 50 to 60 years, there had been a vast amount of kind of agrarian-based emigration from Germany, from Austria, to Patagonia, especially in southern Argentina, in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And so by the 1930s, you had very, very large German communities serving, living and existing over there.
Right.
And you also had some extremely large Nazi Ausland organisations, foreign organisations there in the 30s as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think if anybody remembers Das Boot, which I'm sure many listeners to this will have seen. There's a, I seem to remember there's a blonde German naval officer serving on the submarine who's actually from Argentina.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't have been uncommon. So a lot, you know, Argentina was kind of, it wasn't a colony, but it was a very popular place. So after the war, where's a good place to go and scuttle off to? Well, go and join your fellow countrymen on the other end of the planet.
Sure.
And of course, you know, if you've gone to Patagonia, you'll realise there are towns there that feel more German than Germany,
yeah.
Especially Bariloche. And you could be walking around Bavaria. You know, it's all very gemütlich and the shops sell bratwurst and you know, really you could be back in Europe. So that's the basic reason.
Okay. And so what was the relationship of Nazi émigrés, if you will, to the regimes in places like Argentina and Brazil? To what extent were the regimes aware of who was entering their country? And to what extent were they complicit with that?
Right. And I think the country we need to look at here specifically, because it was the most favourite port of call for your fleeing Nazi, was Argentina.
Yes.
And some of the initial research carried out about the Juan Perón's regime's complicity was carried out by an excellent journalist called Uki Gonyi. And I used some of his research as the basis for what I then went on to do with my book, Hunting Evil, which is my account of how the Nazis escaped and how they were tracked down or not. I suspect we'll come on to that. But yes, so certainly Perón was a fascist, as is well known.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, he had no objections to fascists coming into his country.
Mm-hmm.
Argentina had actually only technically been at war with the Third Reich, and I think it had declared war on Nazi Germany 1 month before the end of the war in Europe.
Yeah.
So it had been, you know, it effectively was a de facto ally.
Yeah.
And so Perón was very happy to have some of these men. Some of them had quite a bit of money. Also, so they were politically at home there. They were financially welcome. Also, a lot of fleeing Nazis had technical expertise.
Yeah.
And so therefore, they were able to provide know-how for various projects that Perón was trying to get underway, especially a form of nuclear power, which ended up being sort of disastrous, but that's another story.
Yeah.
But don't forget, you know, Argentina wasn't the only country exploiting Nazi Germany's technical know-how. Of course, the Americans were doing it, the Brits were doing it, and of course, it's the exploitation of Wernher von Braun that gets mm-hmm. the United States to the moon.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we've got to be very careful before we wrap Perón over the knuckles. But certainly, no, he was very much ask no questions. You know, you're a German coming into Argentina between 1945 and 1950 on a Red Cross passport. Chances are you were a bad boy.
Yeah. There was, as I remember it, evidence that emerged, I think, in the 1990s with Eva Perón's signatures over various sort of immigration papers that she personally signed. So what was the route? If you were
what's the tour bureau? What's the sort of, you know, what if you wanted to retrace the steps, how you'd do it?
Yes.
Well, there were lots of different routes, but the most sort of notorious route starts off at somewhere in Germany, and then you make your way to the next village or the next town.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that you and I are Nazis on the run. This is what we're going to do. Now, first of all, what I'd like to nail here, and which is important, is this whole idea of the Odessa, which I assume you've heard of. Odessa, which is popularised in the book and then subsequent film, the book by Frederick Forsyth, of course, supposedly stands in German for the organisation of former SS men.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realise, like Wernher von Braun, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realise that if you're going to create a secret Nazi society of former SS men, you're not going to call it the Organisation of Former SS Men.
No.
Or SS members.
No.
So, actually, Odessa was basically a disinformation campaign carried out by the Soviets to promote the idea that the West was harbouring these people.
Yeah.
It's largely nonsense, but it makes a good tale.
Mm-hmm.
What you would do is you know, there would be informal networks all over the country. So, for example, if I'm trying to escape, or you and I are trying to escape to the next town, well, we may know of a fellow Nazi who might be able to sort of help us out. And you work your way down what is an informal structure.
Yeah.
You know, it's an old boys' network, effectively. You know, Well, you were at the same school together, so we'll help each other. We're in the SS, we'll help each other.
Mm-hmm.
Those loyalties run deep. They've been running for decades. Because, you know, the Nazis came to power in 33, but, you know, the SA and the SS and the Nazi Party had existed, a good 10 years before that.
Sure.
So these had been decade-long loyalties.
Yeah.
Decade-long loyalties. And so you would then make your way, ultimately, to the Alps. That would be your big barrier if you were heading south.
Mm.
And yes, there were guides who would take you across the Alps. And Joseph Mengele, who's the subject of my next book, walked over the Brenner Pass in about the space of an hour or two. My wife and I have done the same route. I've trodden the same route. Got some nice pictures I put in my book. Very pretty walk it is too. It doesn't take a long time to get from Austria into Italy.
No.
It's not a difficult walk. And from there, you then make your way maybe south to Genoa, the mm-hmm. Italian port. And it's along the way you are provided with documentation, largely either by the Red Cross, you're using a false name, and you're being certified under your false name by maybe a friendly Catholic priest.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot is said about the Roman Catholic Church complicity with Nazism. It's a huge topic. My argument is there was no sense that the Catholic Church as a corporate entity helped Nazis,
yeah.
but certainly there were Catholic priests who did. And one of the most celebrated was a man called Bishop Alois Hudal, who was head of the Austro-German Seminary in Rome, part of the Vatican. And he certainly did provide papers and documentation for fleeing Nazis. Yeah. Amongst them, a man called Franz Stangl, who some will know was the commandant of Treblinka.
Yes.
About 800 to 900,000 Jews were murdered. And as such, he's probably one of the greatest mass murderers of history.
Mm-hmm.
And I found his documentation in the Hudal archive in Rome.
Right.
So, yes, and then you would get to Genoa with your passport and you would get on board a boat to Genoa, and 6 to 8 weeks later, you would end up in Buenos Aires with
right.
your false papers. You were nodded through to your new life.
Right.
So this was the kind of classic route.
And what, talking about numbers here, how many do you think, I mean, it might be difficult to give a full figure, but how many do we think actually made it out?
Well, that is a very good question, because there is no kind of, you know, existing formal, digitised, documented, catalogued Argentina immigration papers
no.
that tell us, right, it's, you know, 26,312. Mm. You've got to be aware of the fact that the volume of criminality was huge. And
wow.
if you look at the nascent United Nations War Crimes Commission's wanted lists, you know, I've got a copy of it here, a facsimile copy of it here. It's about 500-600 pages thick with about 50 names on each page.
Yeah.
You know, I think one British war crimes investigator said they were simply unprepared for the volume of criminality.
Yeah.
Certainly we're talking of tens of thousands going to different places all over the world. Yeah, maybe not tens of thousands, maybe 10,000 to 20,000, but, you know, not hundreds of thousands.
No.
But you've also got to remember that a lot of these Nazis, some of them were well-heeled and had kind of looted the bank before they left.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a lot who didn't have a lot of money, and they ended up in very menial roles in Argentina and Brazil. So, you know, it's always tempting to think about the mythology of Nazis, you know, in Argentina and Brazil and South America, which is of a kind of Fourth Reich, whereas actually the reality these people were living in was very different.
Yeah. Now, if you were to take the vast majority of those who slipped beneath the radar, those who were complicit in not just the Holocaust, but in the kind of the devastation of the Soviet Union and other crimes, of course, the majority of those people would have actually stayed in Germany. Throughout the kind of the 50s, 60s and 70s, whenever former German SS guards were put on trial, they weren't extradited from Brazil. They were found in sort of Stuttgart.
Yes.
And so there's a whole kind of other side of this story about the inability to bring Nazis to justice. That's I mean, the kind of the Boys from Brazil side of things is really kind of the very sort of, as I said, mythologized spy novel kind of version of things. But in reality, most if you look at the kind of the fairly ineffectual denazification of the four Allied zones. Well, actually, the Soviets did it quite well, but that's a slightly different conversation. But a great many people were able to just re-assimilate themselves back into urban life with big consequences for Germany later down the line. That's an interesting other sort of...
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right that actually most Nazis didn't need to hightail it, you know, across the Atlantic to the Southern Hemisphere. You know, you were probably better off just staying put, keeping quiet, either if you had some useful intelligence volunteering your service to the British, French or American or Russian intelligence agencies. That would give you a kind of free pass for any bad stuff you'd done in the past.
Yeah,
that's obviously morally difficult, but, you know, the new enemies, the new enemy was the Soviet Union, and if you have a Nazi criminal in front of you who's going to give you some decent information about your new enemy, well, you're going to have to kind of deal with someone you don't like.
Well,
that's how intelligence works, and it's not pretty.
Well, there's a fascinating bit in Post-War by Tony Judd, where he basically says that in the Soviet-occupied zones, the former Gestapo men who hadn't been rounded up and shot were basically said, there's a train leaving to Siberia in half an hour, or you can help form this new organisation that's going to become the Stasi later on.
Yes.
Here's your copy of Karl Marx and the works of Stalin. Get reading. And there were some remarkably speedy converts.
What are you going to do? I mean, so certainly coercion was there as well.
Yeah.
But you know, most people were going to... You know, whoever won the fight, you're going to work for the winner. You're not going to work for the loser.
No.
So I think that the question was also about the fact that you have these sort of more modest individuals who've committed war crimes, who may have shot a downed RAF pilot or blah, 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 blah. And there were ineffectual attempts to bring them to justice. I mean, I spoke to a man called Lieutenant Colonel Nielsen, who lives quite near me, or used to live quite near me in Wiltshire. He was head of the British War Crimes Investigation Team, a half-colonel at the time, and I mentioned about the United Nations War Crimes list that I made reference to earlier in our conversation, Nick. And he had never heard of these lists, and these were the wanted lists, and he never had them. Yeah. So the whole thing, you know, in the chaos of post-war Germany was all a bit, you know, chaotic, you know, a bit ineffectual. The people working for the War Crimes Investigations Units weren't necessarily the pick of the bunch.
No.
Getting around Germany, as you might imagine, was pretty difficult. The winters were tough in the late 40s. Roads were in a terrible state of repair. It was very difficult gaining access to pathologists, digging up remains, gathering evidence. Yeah. I mean, what you're trying to do is carry out about 100,000 manhunts.
Yeah.
And a single manhunt requires an enormous amount of resources, as we know. So the idea that you're doing 100,000 manhunts around Germany and trying to rebuild it, trying to denazify it, you know what? People just wanted to get on with their lives. The war was costly, it was over, and people didn't want to be defined by it anymore.
No.
And there was a sense that things needed to be wound up.
Yeah.
So by about 48, 49, the British War Crimes Team was wound up. It wasn't tokenism, but it was felt that ultimately this could go on for decades. And frankly, what was the point? And also, even Churchill himself had issued a kind of warning. I think it was during the war or just afterwards, saying, you know, the more we bang on, the more we're going to, the light is going to be turned on us. What crimes did we commit? Us, the Americans, you know, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So, you know, this idea of victor's justice, there were some on the winning side who felt uneasy about that.
Yeah.
And it was also felt that Nuremberg hadn't necessarily put a line underneath it, but had shown certainly that there was some atonement done in a justicial fashion.
Yeah. There's a terrific book by Dermot Jeffries called Hell's Cartel. I'm not sure if you've read it. It's about the industrialists' trial of 1947.
Yeah.
And the thing that's I always find really interesting about that is that the industrialists' trial is the only trial that really is actually about the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Everything else was about the preemptive wars of aggression against Britain and France and the Low Countries and Europe. And finally, the industrialists' trial, the trial of I.G. Farben, was the one where they could actually prove that slave labour had been involved. And it was, and obviously the slave labour, you know, 99% of it had been Jewish. And it, that shines a real light on kind of the post-war prerogatives when it came to this idea of justice. Not to suggest that there was some sort of, you know, kind of anti-Semitic intent on the half of the Allies, certainly not. But there is the kind of the focus of what you find, the wrongs you're actually trying to right.
Yeah.
It was a lot different than I think the popular perception is now.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I also think, can you remind me what year the industrialist trial
47.
Was? 47. Right, 47. But the idea of the Holocaust, which you made reference to there, it wasn't kind of cemented in the widespread imagination, you know, in the way it is today.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't until the trial of Adolf Eichmann in Israel in the early 60s in which the idea of the Holocaust starts becoming widespread.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of a more widespread feeling, you know, sort of transmitted, you know, by sort of people who claim to be Nazi hunters, that this crime, this was a genocide, and it just wasn't just the horrible things that happened in the camps.
Sure.
I think that people weren't really aware of quite how structural this program, this horrific program, had been. And so, yes, clearly at Nuremberg, the tribunal, there were references to charges for crimes against humanity, but you know there wasn't the kind of Holocaust branding, if you like.
Yeah.
So yes, I think you're right. I think the various doctors' trials make reference to obviously things done against Jews in the camps. But yes, certainly I think you're right. And this also feeds into what I think is a really important point. It's this idea that these Nazi war criminals, people like Eichmann, sitting in, you know, unmolested in Argentina, Brazil, Joseph Mengele, the famous doctor, quote-unquote, of Auschwitz, living in Buenos Aires, his name in the phone book under the name Jose Mengele.
Mm.
I mean, you know, not really disguised. A lot of people say, oh, well, the British and the CIA, they just left them alone, the Germans left them alone. Well, you know, frankly, whose job was it to hunt these people?
Mm.
They'd committed no crimes against the British or the Americans.
Yeah.
The Israelis was a fledgling state. Israel was a fledgling state with present-day enemies on her own doorstep to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't have the resources, you know, to go around hunting every single person who had committed grievous acts against.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
against Jewish people.
Yeah.
You know, they had to get on with fighting the wars on their doorsteps. And that's why the Eichmann thing was extraordinary, because there were very few actions carried out by Israeli intelligence against former Nazis.
Well, that's what I wanted to come on to, because there is there's a lot about the abduction of Adolf Eichmann that, again, it sort of passes into modern folklore in a way.
Yeah. But
by and large, even, you know, nation states are rarely motivated by revenge. Not that people don't feel revenge or feel grievance or rage or whatever. But normally, you can have nations where all sorts of dreadful things have happened to the population. And they fairly soon afterwards, their leadership have to be pragmatic and are pragmatic about what can be achieved. But in the case of Eichmann, this complicated and quite risky intelligence operation to abduct him, it's kind of like an outlier in sort of world affairs, really, that I can't think of many parallels of going to that length. Not that it's a bad thing. I mean,
but it is extraordinary, and I think that is there is. I mean, the Mossad certainly. I mean, I read about I can't remember now, but about Mossad operations against, you know, other enemies, and I think certainly it was very rare. There was another, there was an assassination attempt, a successful one carried out against a Latvian called Herbert Zuckers. Which was successfully carried out in the 60s by the Mossad in Montevideo. Herbert Zuckers was a vile man who's known as the hangman of Riga, the number of Jews he had killed in that Baltic state. So, yes, but even then, still very, very rare that you're fleeing Nazi really expect someone to be knocking on your door in the middle of the night and dragging you out and shooting you. Mm. I mean, certainly there were members of the Jewish Brigade in the British Army who carried out freelance Nazi hunting operations in
1945-1946
in Austria, and I write about them in my book.
Yes.
But those were ad hoc, and they weren't done in the name of an Israeli state, because the Israeli state didn't exist, but
no.
Certainly done in the name of the Jewish people. And it also brings on this very complicated figure of Simon Wiesenthal, if you want to talk about him, because certainly in my book, I do give him a very hard time, because I regard him as a sort of an appallingly sort of inflated figure who was really a self-publicist.
Yes.
Really didn't help matters at all, but we can talk about that if you like.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's a key figure in this whole in this whole narrative. And in my previous work, I can't do it now because of various commitments. I worked as a Holocaust educator for the Holocaust Education Trust, and I've been back and forth to Auschwitz dozens of times, and so I've had numerous conversations with people far more learned than myself on the subject of Simon Wiesenthal. And he's one of those figures who, over time, you know, he was an iconic figure in the 60s and 70s of this sort of dogged search for justice. But as you examine And as he's critically examined over time, yes, this figure, this kind of rather egomaniacal self-publicist it emerges. What was his actual contribution to bringing Nazi war criminals to justice, if anything at all?
Well, I give him a real pasting in my book, and I was very worried about it because clearly he's just kind of, as you say, an iconic figure. He's an iconic Jewish figure. And, you know, you run a real risk that if you start laying into people like Simon Wiesenthal, that people may misperceive you to be anti-Semitic in some way.
Yeah.
And especially sort of, dare I say it, sort of posh British historians like me, they're just going to think, well, you're sort of another David Irving type. Or, you know, why have you got it in for Wiesenthal? Didn't he do a good job? When I originally sold my book to my publisher, I had always, you know, put in my proposal to my book that Wiesenthal was a massive figure, an important figure, and you know, what I thought was the great man that he was. But as I went through the archival matter, some of which was from the Simon Wiesenthal Center,
yeah,
it became increasingly clear to me this man was a bullshitter. He was a self-publicist, and he claimed to have tracked down hundreds, if not a thousand Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the figure is less than 10, maybe even less than 6.
Yeah.
He basically made out that he was the only person in the world hunting these people down, and he was sort of popularized in various films.
Yeah.
Like the Odessa File, like the Boys from Brazil. And so he sort of, the romantic image of a Holocaust survivor, which indeed he was, really took hold in the popular imagination.
Yeah.
And in the wake of the Eichmann kidnap, where there was an information vacuum about who had carried out this operation, because the Israelis didn't publicly admit they had,
yeah,
and they certainly weren't going to admit to how they'd done it, you suddenly have people like Wiesenthal stepping out of the woodwork saying, it was me, I was the one who tracked him down, I was the one who did it. It just wasn't true, really not true. There are archives that I can bore you to pants about, bore you to tears about.
I suppose if you're an intelligent, the director of an intelligence agency, and you have a kind of a self-publicist shooting their mouth off about something you've done, it's actually quite helpful, because nobody has to ask what you did.
And certainly he was a source for Mossad for many things. He had lots of tittle-tattle about former Nazis kicking around. He was just another source for Mossad, and the material he did give them on Eichmann, such as it was woefully inaccurate and outdated. And there was far more, far better intelligence coming from other sources than Wiesenthal. Wiesenthal never went to Latin America.
No.
He never went to the ABC Cafe in Buenos Aires, where Eichmann and Mengele would have a beer. It was very easy to go to Latin America, and you do have other Nazi hunters in the forms of a very brave couple who are still alive, Serge and Beata Klarsfeld.
Mm-hmm.
And they, a French-German couple who spent much of the 70s and 80s at great personal risk going to these Latin American dictatorships and haranguing them about the likes of Klaus Barbie, who were living more or less openly in these societies.
Yeah.
And they were really, I have a lot of time for Beata Klarsfeld. She really did walk the walk and talk the talk.
Sure.
Wiesenthal did a lot of talking, but not a lot of walking. And as one Israeli ambassador said, Wiesenthal was a Nazi hunter, but not a Nazi finder.
Yeah.
And I think that probably sums him up. I don't want to bang on for too long about it. It's all in the book.
Yeah.
But certainly he is a problematic figure as far as I'm concerned.
Well, the thing is, that's what I genuinely believe that's what you have to engage with as a historian, problematic figures with big legacies that are often, sacred cows.
Yes.
You have to be honest about them and look at them as objectively as you can. I think the final thing that I wanted to talk about was there's a lot of very interesting stuff written about, and this actually ties into part of the story of the Odessa File. So we have to leap into fiction for a moment. Part of the kind of the subtext of the Odessa File is that the main protagonist is a young man in the 1960s. Discovers that his father was murdered by the SS during the war. There had been a German soldier shot by an SS man during the war. And there's a bit in Frederick Forsyth obviously researched this very, very well, because you see it's coming up in social histories of Germany time and time again, of the main protagonist talking to his mother saying, what did Dad do during the war? And the mother saying, oh, don't go over all that again. And that was really, really common. We had this awful time, it ended very badly, I don't want to talk about it, and it's because, Dad was probably a mass murderer. Dad did some stuff in Russia and we don't go there. And part of this is to do with the failure to bring large numbers of Nazis to book, to really give a completely clean slate. I mean, I think of all the countries in Europe now, Germany's probably done the most to address its Holocaust past, because the responsibility spreads far, far and wide. But you have a period in the 60s and 70s of student unrest and things like the Red Army faction and bombings and that kind of thing. And it's due to many, many things, but in part it's due to the fact that you have all these skeletons in society's closet, and the and you know, all these questions that young people had of, you know, what was it exactly that your generation did? And that for me is one of the really fascinating questions about the shadow of guilt hanging over post-war Germany. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you're right, and I think that Forsyth, when I interviewed him for my book, you know, he did say that some of the encounters with officialdom that Peter Miller, his hero, had, were basically just direct reportage of what Forsyth had when he was researching the book.
Yeah.
Slam doors, can't help you, you know, probably your mysterious phone call. Yes, and certainly I've got a very interesting book called The Brown Book, which is actually published, but I can see it on my shelf now, published by the East Germans in the 60s, showing that how West Germany was riddled with former Nazis in politics, the mm-hmm. judiciary, so on and so forth. And one has to take it with a little bit of a pinch of salt, because obviously it was published by a communist regime that was desperate to prove that the other half of Germany was worse than it.
Yeah.
So I think that you're absolutely right. I think that denazification had only been partially achieved. I think you've got the obvious problems that if you completely denazify, you're going to be left with no one to sort of run things, because there were so many people were members.
Yeah.
And I think that there was just this, you know, appalling incident, I think, in what was called the Monopole Grimberg coal mine, in which we, the British, hadn't allowed Nazis to, former Nazis to run the mine, and there was a fire on the ground. And the only people who could really sort of save these poor hundreds of miners trapped underground were the kind of former Nazi senior technicians in the mine and various executives, and they'd all been denazified. They weren't allowed to work there. Mm. And so I think that the British officer in charge said, I can't bring these men back today because they're being denazified. Mm. And the men in the coal mine died as a result of this sort of slavish, almost sort of moronic adherence to denazification. So it just sort of shows you that actually, you could actually threaten lives by removing useful members of the community. And some people had joined the Nazi Party at a lip service.
Well,
and of course, that, you know, that these were categorised. But certainly, yes, there is a sort of popular idea that West Germany was riddled with former Nazis in the higher places who had this sort of kind of old boys network to help each other and help cover up each other's crimes. I mean, that's certainly true. I think that it's the younger generation, there was a lot of resentment towards the younger generation because, of course, they were innocent. And of course, it's very easy for people like us, Nick, to be very morally comfortable.
Yeah.
We're both Brits, so we were on the winning side, yes, and we were on the side that wasn't fascism. And, you know, we never had to sort of, you know, we've never had as people, apart from the exception of the Channel Islands, had to sort of engage with the realities of living in a regime, mm-hmm. engage with the realities of living under the jackboot, because, as you say, the complicity in the Holocaust wasn't just reserved to Germany and Austria.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, it's very easy to make these sort of moral judgments and pat ourselves on the head and say, we wouldn't have done that, and after the war, you know, how would we have come to terms with it? These are very difficult questions, and they do run very deeply. So, yes, I'm not forgiving cover-up and complicity, but certainly I think we need to understand it, need to understand that people don't behave brilliantly when they're faced with these incredibly difficult moral questions.
Well, this is it, and the occupying forces, I think, very quickly came to see that they had to build new states with the pieces they'd been left, and that there were no attractive answers. There was, I remember, at I think it was the Yalta conference, where Stalin, half joking to Churchill, said, "Well, all you do is the way you deal with it is you just shoot the top 50,000 members of the regime." Churchill said, "No, yeah, this is an unconscionable act. You can't do that."
Yeah.
And so instead, you have to build societies with the rather unpleasant pieces that you've been left, and there's a. In terms of like Nazidom or kind of being this thing called a Nazi, there are ranges of engagement, and probably everybody in Germany had some degree of engagement with the regime from being a party member to a party activist to an actual perpetrator of crimes to simply a reluctant bystander thinking, well, this is all pretty awful and this war is going to end badly, but I suppose we best just get on with it and muddle through. And being able to, as a British or an American officer, being able to discern who's who is a virtually impossible task.
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, and certainly some of the Germans I was dealing with were very sophisticated intelligence officers who ran rings around, a sort of 24-year-old, British Army intelligence officer from sort of, Bedfordshire.
Yeah.
That had no idea what he was dealing with. So, the people, we were out of our depth with some of these people. We really were.
Yes. Yes. Well, what I'd like to do, Guy, is obviously you've got a book about Joseph Mengele coming out. Is that later this year or is it 2021?
No, I haven't even started writing a word yet.
Oh, right, okay.
So if people want to be introduced to my my work, they could kick off with Hunting Evil, which is my account of how the Nazis escaped after the war or how they were tracked down or not. Okay. And now I'm just starting work. I've just signed my deal, a new two-book deal, to do a book about Joseph Mengele, who does feature in Hunting Evil, which will be coming out in January 2022. Okay. So a bit of a wait.
Great.
And then about a year later, I will hopefully also will be publishing in time a history of the Gestapo.
Right.
So to plenty of other reasons to talk to you, Nick.
Great. Well, we'd love to have you back on the podcast. Hopefully we'll chat again soon. That's Hunting Evil in all good bookshops. We'll finish there, Guy. And I'd just like to say on behalf of all the listeners, thank you so much for your time and your knowledge and your excellent repartee.
Thank you very much for having me. I look forward to being on again. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Guy. So thanks for listening, everybody. And we will finish there. And you can, of course, catch up with us at the Explaining History Facebook group. And if you're so inclined, follow us on Patreon. The podcast is funded by a number of generous patrons and, of course, a tiny little trickle of ad revenue. So anything that you can contribute, always gratefully received. Thanks very much, everybody. All the best. Bye-bye.